How important is jury selection?
I think jury selection is where cases are won and lost.
In this case?
I think that it's going to be enormous here.
Judge Marchand has ruled that the jurors' identities will remain a secret.
Yes. I think there's a real risk of intimidation of jurors if this information came out, not by Donald Trump himself, but by those who remain quite committed to him.
That's constitutional law expert Melissa Murray on the challenges of selecting and protecting a jury for Donald Trump's Manhattan trial. I'm Margaret Hoover. This is the Firing Line podcast. For the first time in American history, a former president is on trial in criminal court.
This is an assault on America. Nothing like this has ever happened before.
The hush money trial in Manhattan is the first of four criminal trials Donald Trump may face, and many legal experts say it's the weakest of the cases.
The defendant is entitled to raise before the judge the fact that this is perhaps an unorthodox step to link the commission of this underlying state-level crime with the prospect of a crime under federal law.
Charges are still pending over Trump's handling of classified documents, his role in the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, and his efforts to overturn the 2020 election in Georgia. But it's increasingly doubtful that any of those trials will begin before November's presidential election.
We have a big timer here. And
a timer for the election, you mean?
Yeah, and it's counting down.
NYU professor Melissa Murray follows all of Trump's legal proceedings closely as the host of the podcast Strict Scrutiny.
Hello, and welcome back to Strict Scrutiny.
And is co-author of a book with former federal prosecutor Andrew Weissman entitled The Trump Indictments, the Historic Charging Documents with Commentary.
You know, Andrew and I talk about this in the book. We don't have a lot of great choices here.
So what if Trump succeeds in stalling his other cases and returns to the White House?
And I think the real question that we're seeing that perhaps we'll get an answer to is, can the courts, can the rule of law constrain this former president who may be a future president and all of the things that he would like to do in this office?
Professor Melissa Murray, welcome to Firing Line.
Thanks for having me.
Former President Donald Trump faces 88 felony charges in four jurisdictions. He is the first former U.S. president to be indicted. Jury selection began this week in Manhattan, making him also the first former U.S. president to face a criminal trial. What is the significance to you of this moment in American history?
Well, so this is something Andrew and I talk about in our book, The Trump Indictments, the Historic Charging Documents with Commentary, but the United States has a kind of American exceptionalism about this prospect of holding former leaders to account. This is not the case in other parts of the world. Other advanced democracies have held individuals, even those who have been heads of state, to account for misconduct that occurred before and after they held office. And I think the significance of Donald Trump going into court last Monday in Manhattan is that we've now joined those other democracies. We've actually joined the rest of the free world in truly being able to hold a former leader to account for
misconduct. Explain to me what you mean by the American exceptionalism.
We've never done this before. I mean, you'll recall Watergate, Richard Nixon. There were some discussions of whether Richard Nixon would be criminally liable for the actions undertaken with regard to Watergate. Certainly, the Watergate burglars were criminally prosecuted for their actions there. But we didn't have a criminal trial of Richard Nixon.
Well, and also we had a pardon
yes,
from the president.
Yes, famously had a pardon by now President Gerald Ford of former President Richard Nixon. But we've never actually had that moment. So everyone is talking about this as an extraordinary step in American public life. And I think that is right. We've never done this before. But certainly there may have been opportunities where perhaps we should have held a former leader to account. And I think one of the things that this particular moment makes clear is that perhaps the misconduct here, as alleged, was so profound that we cannot be exceptional. We actually have to be like other countries if we want to continue to be a democracy. We have to hold this conduct to account.
I think I take exception with your characterization of American exceptionalism as the reason why we haven't prosecuted a former leader.
I don't think it's a normative point. I think it's just merely descriptive. We have never done this. It is part of our own system, I think, of seeing ourselves as perhaps distinct from other countries.
The Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg, his prosecution of Donald Trump centers on allegations that Trump paid hush money to silence claims of affairs before the 2016 election. The prosecution charges that Trump falsified business records to cover up the payments and in doing so allegedly interfered in the election. The case rests on what some call a novel legal theory.
Yeah.
Explain this novelty.
So in the New York system, the falsification of business records is ordinarily a misdemeanor crime. However, in circumstances where the falsification of business records is intended to further the commission of another crime, it can be elevated to a felony. And so this is known as bootstrapping. And the theory of the case, as it's been explained in both the indictment and the bill of particulars, which Andrew and I replicate in our book, the idea here is that the falsification of business records was undertaken in furtherance of the commission of essentially election fraud at both the state and federal levels and tax fraud.
So there's a jurisdictional question here,
yes,
then too, because
yes,
the district attorney of Manhattan can prosecute crimes committed in his district, but
right,
a federal election crime mm-hmm, is a wholly other jurisdiction. So you recognize that there are legal valid questions.
For sure. This, I think, happens in a lot of prosecutions. There will be legal questions that are raised that are questions of first impression. This will certainly be one of them. And the defendant is entitled, as part of his defense, to raise before the judge the fact that this is perhaps an unorthodox step to link or bootstrap the commission of this underlying state-level crime with the prospect of a crime under federal law. But to be clear, D.A. Bragg has also suggested that the extra crime that this might be bootstrapped to doesn't have to be the federal election
law.
Because
we don't know yet.
We don't actually know
what the underlying crime is.
So there's been discussions of state-level crimes, state-level election crimes, federal election crimes, and also state-level tax crimes.
Another piece that's rather novel is that the statute of limitations had expired on this kind of a business crime, but for the pandemic, potentially.
Right. So during the pandemic, Andrew Cuomo, who was then the governor of New York State, issued an executive order that essentially paused all of the statute of limitations on crimes because no one was in a position to investigate any crimes because people were sheltering in place, mm-hmm, they were in their homes. We basically had the justice system grind to a halt. And so that executive order recognizes that pauses the statute of limitations on the commission of some of these crimes, and essentially gave about a year of an additional time frame in order to bring these cases.
Which this just barely fits.
Barely made it. And it's also noteworthy, in the indictment, D.A. Bragg speaks of the falsification of business records with regard to alleged payments to Karen McDougal, but those are not part of the charges that are brought against Donald Trump. It's just sort of added, I think, to corroborate the charges that have been already included in the indictment, but those are not included as separate charges, in part because they would fall outside of the statute of limitations.
Federal prosecutors and D.A. Bragg's predecessor, Cy Vance, refused to bring this case, or declined to bring this case. Others have said that Bragg lacks the necessary jurisdiction because he's dealing in part with federal election laws. We talked about that. Does it give you pause that Bragg's predecessor declined to bring the case forward?
Well, I mean, again, I don't want to comment on what those earlier administrations done. I will note that there was considerable discussion of the fact that Cy Vance declined to prosecute the Trump children for alleged crimes that had occurred with regard to the Trump Soho Hotel, and that he had also received campaign contributions from members of the Trump family, which were later returned to the family. So, you know, again, I think there's a lot that you could say about what earlier administrations did or did not do. And, you know, there's a lot you could say about the reactions of individuals like Mark Pomerantz, who were on this case before Alvin Bragg. All I will say about Alvin Bragg's decision is that the burden of proof in a criminal case rests with the government and the prosecutor, and the government has to establish its case beyond a reasonable doubt. That's an incredibly high standard. The government is fighting uphill, and so I would like to think that D.A. Bragg, having a full understanding of the evidence that is in his court, would know whether or not he has the goods to make his burden and would not undertake such a high-profile prosecution in the absence of a really strong showing that he could make that burden.
Okay, I want to get to jury selection, but first, okay, I want to ask you about the political implications of this.
Yeah.
I'm not going to ask you to comment on the politics, but the fact that this is political is inevitable because the defendant is a former U.S. president and the presumptive Republican nominee for the presidency in November. Bragg also campaigned on a platform to hold Trump accountable, mm-hmm, often saying that he had sued Trump over 100 times, which may not have been accurate. But it does help fuel this narrative that the prosecution is politically motivated.
Yeah.
How does that impact the trial?
So I think it impacts the trial in a couple of ways. And the trial, of course, is happening with the backdrop of an ongoing election cycle where Donald Trump is the nominee of his party for president. So none of these things can be divorced. They're inextricably linked to each other, even as the legal system operates in a way that is distinct from politics. I think this is going to shade jury selection. It means that every decision that is made here has the capacity to be refracted through the lens of politics, even if it is actually just a legal decision. And certainly, there is broad incentive for the defendant to frame what is happening to him, not as the ordinary workings of a legal system, but rather the machinations of a political persecution that has been lobbied against him.
In Manhattan in 2020, in the presidential contest between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, Joe Biden won 86% of the vote. Donald Trump won 12% of the vote. One could simply, with those odds, ask, how on earth could the defendant get a fair trial, mm-hmm. just given the odds mm-hmm. of selecting a pool of jurors that would be inclined to think of him in a completely neutral way?
So, I think that's a great question. I think jury selection is going to be really fraught. And again, the idea that Donald Trump is entitled to a jury of his peers, that does not mean he is entitled to a jury of his peers all wearing red hats. And so I think that's really important. A jury of your peers does not have to be a jury of individuals who are sympathetic to you, who share your political views. It just has to be 12 people who are committed to approaching the evidence with an open mind. And I think most individuals who are called to jury service, which is all of us at mm-hmm. some point in our adult lives, recognize that when you step into the jury box, you are shedding all of the trappings of your former life to some degree. Like, you have to approach this with an open mind. It's the reason why jury selection is so particular, and I think why it's going to be especially particular in this case, to try and weed out those individuals who cannot approach this with an open mind. So yes, you may have a jury that is overwhelmingly committed to the Democratic Party in terms of their partisan affiliation, but I don't think that necessarily means that you don't have 12 people who will not be able to approach the evidence presented with an open mind, and recognizing that the defendant doesn't have to do anything here. Everything is on the government to establish its case beyond a reasonable doubt.
How important is jury selection?
I think jury selection is where cases are won and lost.
In this case, will it depend on the jury?
I think that it's going to be enormous here. And I think you're going to see both the prosecution and the defense really be attentive to who they are impaneling on this jury as jurors and as alternates.
Judge Marchand has ruled that the jurors' identities will remain a secret.
Yes.
Because of a, quote, likelihood of bribery, jury tampering, or of physical injury or harassment of jurors.
Yes.
How difficult in a case this high profile will it be to keep jurors' identities secret?
We live in an online world. I think even to the degree that this information is not being made public, it is being revealed to some degree to the lawyers who are working on this case. And again, I think it is incumbent on both sides to maintain the privacy of the prospective jurors. We have seen over the last couple of years, the political temperature is just really high. And I think it's especially high around Donald Trump and his followers. I think there's a real risk of intimidation of jurors if this information came out, not by Donald Trump himself, but by those who remain quite committed to him. That's not the only thing I think they have to worry about in terms of jury service, but it's already difficult, I think, to get individuals to commit to jury service because it requires time away from family, time away from your job. It's a true civic duty. And if you layer on top of that the prospect, like, oh, maybe now people find out where I live and I'm going to get harassed, I'm going to be intimidated. Nobody would want to do this, and certainly nobody would want to do it for a big, high-profile trial such as this without those protections.
In this case, if there is one juror who is persuaded that Donald Trump is innocent, that's all it will take.
That's all it takes. That's not enough for an acquittal. It is enough for a mistrial, and that may be all Donald Trump wants. Again, the way this shakes out in a criminal trial is the burden is on the government. This is about the deprivation of liberty. Here, it may not be a long deprivation of liberty. The penalties are relatively low here. But the idea is, in a situation where an individual faces the loss of liberty, the burden should be on the state to establish that this person is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And for the defendant to prevail, all you need is a single person who's like, I don't think the government made that burden.
D.A. Bragg's key witness is likely to be Michael Cohen.
Yes.
The former Trump lawyer who has already been convicted of perjury. How does a prosecutor convince a jury that someone who has already been convicted of lying is now telling the truth?
So again, this is another place where this isn't that different from a lot of other criminal trials where I think the state's evidence will rest on a cooperating witness who himself may not have the cleanest hands, who has a pretty checkered past. So this isn't that unusual, although, you know, Michael Cohen is well known to most of America, certainly for his past criminal convictions, the fact that he admits to having perjured himself. It's going to be, I think, difficult for the prosecution to withstand efforts by the defense to impeach Michael Cohen's credibility. And I think the way that they do that is to corroborate Michael Cohen's story. So I think we are going to see, in addition to Michael Cohen, testimony from other witnesses who perhaps have less checkered pasts who might be able to corroborate some of the story that Michael Cohen is telling. And again, trials are storytelling hours. Like, that's the whole thing. Can you construct a narrative that this jury can buy into? And sometimes that's having one character who the jury believes, but sometimes if you have a character who is a little less savory, you've got to add in other characters to build them back up.
D.A. Bragg is an elected Democrat who won a Democratic primary in one of the most Democratic cities in the country. Yeah. You know, there's an optics challenge, of course, here that former President Trump will, of course, exploit for his political supporters. But there's also this real question, I think observers raise, about the precedent of prosecuting political opponents. You hear this from the president's own words, but you actually can imagine a scenario in a sort of legal arms race where this normalizes prosecuting political opponents. How do you think about that?
So again, I think that the legal system is meant to withstand these kinds of shocks. And, you know, Andrew and I talk about this in the book. We don't have a lot of great choices here. Yes, we could try and insulate the legal system and insulate the prospect of future leaders not being harassed by state level or local prosecutors going forward by just giving this a wide berth. But then we also have this question, is the president above the law? And I think you can't reconcile those two things without making some difficult choices. Like, do we live in a democracy? Do we live in a country that abides by the rule of law? If the answer is yes, then you have to take some chances that you may set up a precedent where this may be used vindictively, that may be used instrumentally going forward by other prosecutors who, you know, someone in Texas wants to sue Joe Biden for violating Texas law. But that's kind of the risk you take if you care about the rule of law. I would like to think that this moment is extraordinary and kind of sui generis, and that for the most part, we would not take such extraordinary steps unless the moment really demanded it. But I think given what we've seen, and again, I don't think you can divorce this particular prosecution from the three others that are going on, there seems to be, given the allegations of criminality, a need to hold this particular former leader to account. And this happens to be the one that's happening right now.
David Boies, a Democrat who famously argued Al Gore's case before the Supreme Court in the 2000 election, has said that, quote, the prospect of criminally indicting a former president is better left to other countries. You have to ask yourself, would these cases have been brought against him if his name were Donald Smith? You say in your book that you wrote with former federal prosecutor Andrew Weissman, the Trump indictments, that reasonable minds may differ over whether the Manhattan charges would have been brought against someone other than Trump. Where do you come down on this question?
So this is a place, I think, where Andrew and I did a lot of talking. I think we agree that in the other three indictments, to not bring criminal charges would have been the selective action, because there are plenty of people in federal penitentiaries right now for keeping classified information in far less quantities than what Donald Trump has been charged with in the Mar-a-Lago case. And we have many January 6th protesters who are currently serving federal sentences for the actions undertaken on January 6th, 2021. So I think that's very clear, like, to not go forward with criminal prosecutions of Donald Trump in those other three cases would be a violation, a dereliction of duty. Mm-hmm. The New York case, I think this is where Andrew and I disagree. New York often prosecutes people for falsification of business records, but it's usually as a misdemeanor crime. So it's the bootstrapping, I think, that makes this more novel, perhaps a little unorthodox, and raises eyebrows. And again, that's the burden that DA Bragg is going to have to clear. And again, Donald Trump, during the course of this trial, can note the novelty of this bootstrapping theory, can note all of the legal problems. So he will have an opportunity to challenge this. But I think, just as a general matter, as DA Bragg has said, and said at his press conference announcing these charges, these are crimes for which ordinary New Yorkers are prosecuted.
Most defendants who go to trial do get convicted. At this early stage, how do you assess the prospect for a conviction?
Hard to say. You're right to note that most defendants are convicted. Most defendants actually plead guilty and never see the inside of a courtroom. And that's for a whole host of reasons. The resources of the government against the rank and file defendant are enormous, mm-hmm, in comparison, mm-hmm, and many people, mm-hmm, don't want to take the chance, and many people don't have access to the kind of legal representation that Donald Trump has. I mean, he has actually fantastic lawyers in this New York case, and I think it's actually going to be an evenly matched setup between the lawyers on both sides. But I will say that in terms of the consideration that Donald Trump has been given as a defendant, he is actually quite exceptional. I don't know that any defendant could have put on social media the information about the judge's daughter or about the judge, or in the civil case, the clerk that served Judge Engoron, and would still be walking around free. Most people would have already been held in criminal contempt. I think we're not seeing that with Donald Trump, again, because of the political valence of this case and the fact that most judges don't want to make a martyr of Donald Trump and know that any actions taken against him would be refracted through the lens of his politics. But all to say, he's probably getting the duest of process at this point. This is the kind of due process that most criminal defendants don't get.
I actually want to ask you about that, but because you mentioned the daughter, Trump has demanded that Judge Merchan actually recuse himself from the trial because, in part, his daughter worked for a firm that does digital campaign work for Democrats, including the Biden-Harris campaign. Merchan has refused to recuse himself in a state Judiciary Ethics Panel actually backed him up on this. You have argued that Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas recused himself from the case of January 6th because, mm-hmm, of his wife's involvement, mm-hmm, in political activity supporting Donald Trump. How is that recusal different than this one?
I think they are different. In the case of Judge Merchan, this is his adult daughter who does not live in his home. And we don't know the nature of her work on the Biden-Harris campaign. She works at this digital company. What we do know, based on the investigation done by the January 6th subcommittee, is that Ginni Thomas was actually sending text messages to Mark Meadows, then the chief of staff, to President Donald Trump on the day of the January 6th siege on the Capitol. Ginni Thomas is not an adult child. She lives in Clarence Thomas's house. She is professed to be his best friend. They regard each other as best friends. And although they maintain that they keep a strict separation between her business and his, I mean, there are reasons why spouses are assumed not to be able to provide testimony against a spouse, like because the marital relationship is one of such profound intimacy that, of course, you are talking to your spouse. So I think it is a little different. And as a general matter, I think when your wife is in a position where evidence against her is part of the case, I think that does require you to be outside of the case in a very clear way.
Trump's legal team reportedly is hoping to seat young black men on the jury who might be amenable to his argument that the justice system is stacked against him.
Yes.
On the original firing line in 1996, one of O.J. Simpson's attorneys, Alan Dershowitz, explains how they had a similar rationale while picking the jury for the O.J. Simpson murder trial.
We understood we had blacks in the jury and that therefore they might be more amenable to what we believed was the true defense in this case, namely that the police had perjured themselves. But for many inner city blacks, they have seen it. They've heard about it from their friends. They've experienced it. And they are more likely to accept a defense based on evidence tampering and perjury by the police. To that extent, race does matter. Just like a woman's jury, a jury consisting largely of women, would be more sympathetic to a battered woman defense in a murder case or to some kind of argument about spousal abuse. Gender, race, ethnicity matter when you're picking a jury and how you're trying a case to the jury.
A predominantly black and female jury ultimately did acquit Simpson. Mm-hmm. How do you see race and gender factoring into the make of this Trump jury?
So Donald Trump has said that black men, young black men, should feel a kind of affinity with him because he, like them, is the unusual target of the criminal justice system. You know, that may be a winning argument to some degree. I mean, I think there are, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about the way in which black men have apparently responded to Donald Trump, certainly since 2020. I don't know that that necessarily holds for black women or for women more generally. I think it'll be really interesting how the allegations of extramarital affairs, like how that plays with a jury and the narrative that is that constructs for the jury as the trial goes on. But in terms of, you know, race mattering, gender mattering, I think it does matter to some degree, but it also plays in both directions here. I mean, it may be the case that Donald Trump is cultivating this line of similarity between himself and young black men, but I think there are going to be lots of people on that jury who also remember when Donald Trump took out a full-page ad in the paper against the Central Park Five, who are now known as the Exonerated Five. I mean, there's a very real story to tell about Donald Trump being part of the railroading of young black men, the same kind of railroading that he now attributes to his own circumstance. So, you know, yes, all of these things matter and they can run in a lot of different directions given the breadth and scope of Donald Trump's actions and profile in New York City.
Well, you recently argued that if any black man had been charged with 91 different crimes, he would already have pled guilty at this point.
Yes, there's also that.
There are three other cases involving Donald Trump. The federal case by Jack Smith on January 6th, the documents case about these classified documents that were taken from the White House, and the Georgia election interference case. What are the chances, in your view, that any of these will come to trial before the election?
Dwindling by the day. You know, you could imagine we have a big timer here. And
a timer for the election, you mean?
Yeah, and it's counting down. It would have been great, and I think it would have been possible for some of these other trials to have started and to have concluded, certainly by September.
Which ones?
I think the Mar-a-Lago documents case could have been conducted and completed by September. I think the January 6th federal election interference case could have been done by September. And I think that would have been really useful information for the American electorate to have. Like, these are situations of disputed facts. The jury system is the system in the Anglo-American legal tradition for resolving disputed facts. We're not going to have that opportunity, I think, in both of those cases, which is really unfortunate. It means that each American is going to have to resolve those facts for herself and likely will do that in the confines of the ballot booth, not necessarily by watching a jury deliberate and sift through the evidence and determine whether the government has proven its case beyond a reasonable doubt.
You seem to be lamenting the slowness with which justice and the justice system, why is it then? Mm-hmm. So let's talk about why they, the reason each of them haven't come to pass. Let's go one by one. You've called the documents case, the Mar-a-Lago documents case, open and shut case.
Yes. Andrew and I both agree, and we discuss this in the book, this is a clear-cut case where the crime is literally having the documents, knowing that you're not supposed to have the documents, knowing that the documents are classified and they're not yours, and keeping them. Mm-hmm. And I think Jack Smith's indictment makes allegations that suggest there's very strong evidence that that is in fact what happened, even leaving aside the question of the obstruction of justice, which is also a charge in that case about moving the documents to ensure that they would not be returned or destroying video evidence showing people moving the documents to ensure that that would not be part of the case. Just by itself, the retention of the documents seems like a pretty open and shut case for the state.
Why should it have come to trial before the election and didn't?
I mean, to my mind, that case is so profound in terms of what it says about the alleged conduct and the implications of that conduct. I mean, these aren't ordinary documents. This is the most sensitive information. This goes to questions of nuclear and military capabilities, assets who are in the field. And Andrew talks about this, mentions it in the book. You know, at one point in time when he was in the Department of Justice, he had classified status. And it made him so uncomfortable to see the documents that he was entitled to view as a virtue of that status that he was just always worried. Like, it's not something that should be taken lightly. This is the most important information. It concerns our assets in the field. It concerns the assets of other countries. It's our national intelligence. Like, this is everything. It's about keeping us safe. It can't be in a gold-plated bathroom in your beach house in Palm Beach.
Is it your view that the reason it won't come to trial is because of delays from the defendant and decisions from the judge?
Yes. I think, I think the defendant, as part of his defense, is entitled to mount a vigorous defense, and that includes making attempts to slow this down. But this comes down to a question of case management and courtroom management, and for that, I think we have to look to Judge Cannon, who, you know, I think generously, you might say she might be a little out of her depth here. She's a relatively new judge. She was appointed by Donald Trump. She does not have a lot of experience doing criminal trials as a lawyer. She was not a criminal trial lawyer. And this case is straightforward in some respects, but also involves questions of evidence that are classified documents, classified information. So you have to deal with the Classified Information Procedures Act. I don't think she has a lot of experience doing that. We have already seen in the discussion of the special master, even before this trial was assigned to her, she made a decision that was appealed to the 11th Circuit, the intermediate appellate court that she answers to, and they rebuked her for getting the law wrong. So I think there have been a lot of questions that might be raised, both about the judgments that she has issued, the things that she is focused on, and the way she's managed this case that really, I think, does raise eyebrows.
Special Counsel Jack Smith's January 6th indictment claims that Trump conspired to steal the election after the election had occurred. This trial was supposed to begin in March. It is on hold while the Supreme Court considers, because to be clear, next week they will hear oral arguments about the immunity of the president. Mm-hmm. What will you be listening for next week? The D.C. Circuit, of course, already ruled that the president is not immune.
So I think, again, the only answer the Supreme Court is going to issue is that it cannot be the case that a president is completely and totally immune from criminal prosecution. That would make the president above the law. It would make the president a king. I can't imagine the court is going to come to that conclusion. What I do think will happen is that there is going to be some glossing of this, sort of talk about what falls within the official actions. Maybe there will be questions about whether or not the scope of what has been alleged in the indictment falls into the category of official versus unofficial acts. So that's a big part of what I'm going to be looking for at oral argument on April 25th. But, you know, honestly, I don't really think that oral argument is going to make much of a difference here. I think the justices recognize what they have to do here in terms of the law and the jurisprudence and just a question of constitutional design and how the executive fits into our system of government and whether the executive is above the law or not. What I'm actually going to be looking for is whether on April 26th we get a ruling in this case, because if we don't, I think then the only conclusion that one could draw is that the Supreme Court, regardless of what it has decided, has effectively immunized Donald Trump from being held to account on the January 6th trial issue, because this trial is never going to go.
You're saying that if they wait any longer, yeah, then they will have effectively delayed, prevented exactly the American people from being able to see the results of this case playing out before the election.
If they don't decide this in short order after oral argument on April 25th, the whole question of presidential immunity is just an academic exercise that will be for law professors and those who write constitutional law casebooks. It's not going to be about this trial.
As a legal scholar, did Smith and his team commit an unforced error by trying to prosecute Trump for his official acts rather than what he did as a candidate?
I mean, I think we're going to find that out depending on what the court has to say
and what we see.
Yeah,
and whether or not they weigh
in. Yeah. I've never been a prosecutor. I have enormous respect for those who are in public service, both on the prosecution and defense. It's a hard job. It is a public service in every sense of the word. I think Jack Smith and his team made a lot of choices going into this because they wanted to be able to have an answer that the American people could have and wrestle with before the election. There are a lot of people who are named as unindicted co-conspirators in that January 6th federal indictment, but the indictment makes a very specific choice to only bring charges against one person, Donald Trump. And again, it's not a panoply of charges. It's a very select group of four charges. And I think that was by design too. They wanted this to be lean. They wanted it to be mean because they wanted it to be resolved.
If the complaint is this has been delayed and it won't be resolved until the election, shouldn't DOJ have started sooner?
I think there's a lot we could say about DOJ at this point. They made a decision to work from the bottom up to prosecute the rank and file protesters before sort of entertaining that question. I think it's very clear that the appointment of Jack Smith as a special prosecutor really occurred because of what happened in the January 6th investigations, the Senate.
On Capitol Hill, completely independent
Congress,
investigations,
yes,
that the Congress pursued,
yes,
and the department that,
yeah,
stimulated the Department of Justice, yeah, to move forward with special prosecutor.
We talk about this in the book as well. I think the Cassidy Hutchinson testimony really took DOJ by surprise. I don't know why it should have. I think if there had been an investigation, her testimony would have been surfaced in that investigation. But ultimately, we had the January 6th subcommittee doing this kind of side investigation, surfacing this for the American people. And that actually may turn out to be an enormous service. Not only did it spur the appointment of Jack Smith, it may actually be the only surfacing of evidence or information about these events that the American people will have in advance of the election.
These federal cases.
Yeah.
If Trump is reelected,
yeah,
What happens to them?
So if Trump is reelected, he will have a new Department of Justice with a new AG who can kill these federal cases. If in the event that a miracle happens and these cases proceed to trial before the election and Donald Trump is convicted on any of these charges, as president, we have now the open question of whether he could self-pardon. Again, it is not a resolved constitutional question. It would be a question, I'm sure, that would go to the Supreme Court, but that could be a question. The state-level cases, both the Manhattan case and the Georgia case, do not offer the opportunity for the sitting president to work either through the DOJ or through his constitutional powers as chief executive to kill those cases. So that's sort of the interesting sort of federalism wrinkle here. If he is convicted in Manhattan, can't really do anything about it. We then have a question of whether a sitting president can serve out his sentence while also serving as president, truly an unorthodox question. But he's not going to be able to kill those cases, and he's not going to be able to pardon a conviction of any of the individuals who are charged and convicted in those cases.
Let me just ask you a couple of questions about Georgia. It has become impossible to talk about the Georgia case now without focusing on the prosecutor, Fannie Willis, and her romantic relationship with her subordinate, Nathan Wade. Of course, Trump moved to remove Willis from,
yeah,
the case. The judge said, of course not, mm-hmm, but was critical of Willis's judgment,
yes, yeah,
and conduct. The judge also forced Wade to resign. What impact did those events have on the outcome of the case?
So, you know, just as a matter of context, almost from the beginning when Fani Willis took over as DA in Fulton County and launched her investigation, as the indictment was announced, there are already efforts to try and have Fani Willis removed from this case. She had already been removed from another case because she had participated in a campaign event for an individual who was on the other side or was on one of the cases. So there had already been, I think, some pretty heavy scrutiny of her. There had already been an attempt.
It was justified in your view?
Sure. I mean, yes. I mean, like those ethical questions, I think, are it's fair to raise. You're a public servant. I just sort of want to make clear, though, that it wasn't as though this particular ethical question just surfaced out of the blue. There had been that particular scrutiny of Fani Willis. There had also been efforts by the administrative arm of the Georgia Prosecutor's Office to consider whether or not her powers should be more limited as DA. I mean, I think we're seeing that kind of move all around the country against progressive prosecutors, and I think she would call herself, characterize herself as a progressive prosecutor. So I wasn't surprised then when Michael Roman, who is one of the defendants in the Georgia election interference case, raised these questions about Fani Willis's relationship with Nathan Wade, who, as we know, she appointed to be a special prosecutor on this case. It's a fair question to raise. It does not diminish the force of the charges against any of the defendants here. And, you know, typically when you have ethical questions involving prosecutors and their private relationships, it's usually that the relationship is with the judge or a juror or with the defense, not that it's with someone on the same side. So I think the same sort of ethical quandary isn't quite present, but the optics of it are obviously
more damaging than anything.
Yeah, and embarrassing for her, I think demoralizing for her team. Mm-hmm. And obviously it led to the removal of Nathan Wade and, you know, what I think was a pretty stunning rebuke from Judge Scott McAfee. And although he has not removed her from the case, that decision has already been appealed. And so it's not a great place for her to be in, perhaps an unforced error on her part, but I do want to emphasize it doesn't diminish any of the charges that she raised against any of these defendants. Will it color a jury if one is ever impaneled and hears this case? Undoubtedly.
Would it be better for the case?
No.
If she were removed?
No, and here's why.
Yeah.
One, she has incredible expertise with Georgia RICO, and she's brought many of these RICO cases.
The
Racketeering Influence Corrupt Organizations Act. There's a federal statute, but also state-level statutes, and Georgia has one, and she is incredibly experienced in bringing those RICO prosecutions in Georgia. It's also the case that were she to step down, her entire team would have to be replaced. And she would have to be replaced, and her replacement would be identified by this sort of administrative body of prosecutors. They have already had the charge of replacing her in the other case from which she was removed because of her relationship with, like, holding a campaign event for one of the individuals there. And they still haven't done that. It's been almost a year, I think, since.
You're saying the consequences on the trial's progress?
I think it slows things down immeasurably. I mean, it's already been slowed down because of the ethics questions that have been raised here. And maybe that was by design, but I think it would be slowed down even more. And it's not entirely clear that the ethical conundrum that we would typically be worried about, again, the prosecutor and the judge, the prosecutor and a witness, the prosecutor and a juror, that's not here.
A couple final big picture questions about all of these legal cases. A common complaint from Trump is that he's a victim of double standards in the legal system, that he's being treated unfairly by all the courts. And I wonder, as you watch him maneuver to stall trials in four different jurisdictions, as he hurls insults at judges, prosecutors, witnesses, is it the reality that he is being treated more harshly than an average defendant in your scholarly view?
I think that he is being treated differently, but it's working to his advantage. Like, this isn't the ordinary situation where you have a defendant who has 91 criminal charges against him. That defendant, the ordinary defendant, would already have pled guilty and would be in a jail cell somewhere. The fact that Donald Trump has the resources to wage a vigorous defense and is waging a vigorous defense and has slowed down these cases, that doesn't happen in most criminal cases. The fact of the matter, the sad fact of the matter is most criminal defendants plead guilty because they don't have the resources for a vigorous defense. They have their cases being dealt with by public defenders who have enormous caseloads and can't give each case the attention that it would need, the attention that Donald Trump is getting. And so this isn't the same thing. In terms of how he's being treated by these judges in these courtrooms, again, a defendant who posted on social media to millions of followers the name of the judge's daughter and said that, you know, she is responsible for influencing this trial, that defendant would already have been held in contempt of court, like criminal contempt. So yes, Donald Trump is being treated differently. He is being treated in a way that no criminal defendant will be treated. He is getting the duest of due process.
It appears likely that Donald Trump will go before voters in November with 3 of 4 cases unresolved.
Yeah.
He is threatening to push the limits of executive power in a second term. What does that tell you about the ability of our institutions to hold him accountable?
Well, I mean, we've already seen that the ordinary restraints that have constrained prior chief executives don't work here. I mean, I teach a case in constitutional law called Nixon versus Fitzgerald. It's about whether or not a sitting president can be held civilly liable for official acts. So sort of a variant on what we're seeing now. In that case, Justice Lewis Powell says that the president cannot be held civilly liable for the actions undertaken in the course of his office. But that doesn't mean the president won't be held accountable. He talks about the prospect of impeachment being a check on the president, the media and media coverage of the president being a check, the prospect of the president caring about his legacy being a check. All of these things, he argues, will instill in a president the desire to behave, to conduct himself in the manner that the office demands and deserves. And when I read that part of the opinion to my students now, this is after 2 Trump impeachments, both failed, they laugh. Like, they literally laugh at the prospect of impeachment being an adequate check on the president, about the president caring what the media says about him, about the president caring about his legacy.
Well, those are political checks and balances. How about the legal checks and balances? Really, from the court, because he has been held accountable by civil courts.
Yes.
Are the courts the only place that can hold the executive accountable?
I think the framers of the Constitution would have seen the courts as a last resort. Like, the idea that we would have someone who would push the boundaries of what is acceptable presidential conduct is so foreign to our system of constitutional design that, yes, I think they would be like, that's the very last resort. Like, that's the last straw. But that's where we're left with. And I think the real question that we're seeing that perhaps we'll get an answer to is, can the courts, can the rule of law constrain this former president who may be a future president and all of the things that he would like to do in this office?
Final question, different topic. You clerked for Justice Sonia Sotomayor. Mm-hmm. There is a growing push for her to consider retiring. She's 69 years old. She is diabetic. Many progressives fear a repeat of what happened with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who refused to retire when President Obama was in office and then died suddenly in Trump's term.
Well, let me say first about Justice Sotomayor. I think the circumstances are very different from the circumstances of Justice Ginsburg. Justice Sotomayor, as you say, is 69 years old. She has never had cancer. Although she has diabetes, she's been managing this condition since she was a child, and she shows no signs of slowing down. And I've seen her. She's showing no signs of slowing down. So I think it's a very different conversation. I also think, were she to step down right now, which is what the calls are for her to do, it isn't obvious that there would be an opportunity to name her successor. Some people have talked about, she could resign conditional upon her successor being appointed and confirmed. I don't know that we could actually have a confirmation. I mean, we've seen how politicized Supreme Court nominations have been. We saw in 2016, Mitch McConnell sort of stonewall the nomination of Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court so that that seat could be left vacant, could energize Republican voters going to the polls in 2016, and again, resulted in the election of Donald Trump and ultimately the appointment of Neil Gorsuch. So, I think there are real questions about whether or not a vacancy right now would be filled and whether the fact of a vacancy wouldn't activate the Republican base in ways that perhaps stymie the very things that Democrats are concerned about. I do think, though, that all of the talk makes clear how important the court is, the degree to which most Americans understand that a 6-3 conservative supermajority has real potential to do deleterious things to the legal system and to the lives of everyday Americans. We've seen this over the course of the last 2 years. And that a 7-2 conservative super majority would be even worse. And so, to my mind, the question isn't about any single Supreme Court justice retiring. The real question is, how are you going to deal with the prospect of a court that wields that much power where a supermajority really becomes problematic? It feels like people understand that the court is out of control. Why don't we focus on that as opposed to whether or not Justice Sotomayor ought to step down? And thinking about, is the court out of control, I think yields a different set of questions. Should we be thinking about court reform more strenuously than we are? Should we be thinking about term limits? Should we be thinking about the size of the court? Should we be thinking about jurisdiction stripping of the court? These are all really important questions. Should we be thinking about making the court an actual issue for liberal and progressive voters in the election as opposed to other elements of the political landscape? I mean, people are talking about student loan relief and how they really want student loan relief. We've had two shots at student loan relief. One was invalidated at the Supreme Court. The other was invalidated a couple of weeks ago at the Fifth Circuit, an intermediate appellate court.
When you say we've had two shots at it, who are you referring to?
The Biden administration has taken two shots at this. People talk about, I don't know if I can vote for Joe Biden because I really wanted student loan relief and it didn't happen. It did happen. It just got killed by a 6-3 majority of the Supreme Court.
When you say the court is out of control, do you mean that it is ruling consistently in ways that are philosophically opposed to the opposite political party? What do you mean when you say the court is out of control?
So we discussed this at length on our podcast, Strict Scrutiny. This is a court that is not necessarily methodologically consistent. It says it subscribes to originalism, which is the sort of idea that you interpret the Constitution in keeping with how the framers or ratifiers of the Constitution would have understood those terms at the founding. But that only works for them when it works for them. They are wildly inconsistent about their application of originalism. They're wildly inconsistent in their application of various methods of statutory interpretation. The case that's being argued this week are Fisher versus United States, which is about the statute, Sarbanes-Oxley Act, can apply to the January 6th protesters. The court has said that they prefer to think about the terms of statutes according to their plain text, but I think we're going to see in that oral argument, they're going to talk about the purposes of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. Was it meant to apply in the context of January 6th? And if they follow a sort of purpose-driven approach, that's going to yield a win for January 6th rioters and Donald Trump in a way that is completely inconsistent with their views of other statutory principles and statutory interpretation principles in other cases that don't necessarily have the same political valence.
Professor Murray, thank you for your opinions. Thank you for sharing your point of view. And thank you for your analysis of this moment. Thank you for joining me here on Firing.
Thanks so much for having me, Margaret.